Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season really is a year-round event. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello, Katie.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
Mike, you're singing because you got the Tonys in your
this
heart,
This is
right?
a Tonys episode. Yeah. I was trying to be Tonys-ish.
Well, it's an award show to talk about that actually matters in this long summer before Oscar season returns. The Broadway Awards show brought in the best ratings it's had in 15 years, and, you know, Hamilton was a big part of that, but also a James Corden as the host. And we kind of wanted to know what the other award shows could learn from the Tonys, maybe, even though the Tonys have always kind of been the little sibling of the Oscars and the Golden Globes, et cetera. And then from there, we'll talk about a piece that our own Julie Miller wrote for VF.com yesterday about how very few millennials are buying tickets to movies this summer, or at least they are dropping off in numbers larger than the rest of the population. This is supposed to be the season where Hollywood makes a huge amount of its money. And does that mean it's time to panic instead? But first, the week in Oscar news, which is really the week in Richard Lawson party-going news. We found out right before we started recording this that you went to see what is a kind of a sleeper Oscar contender, but probably a real one, Florence Foster Jenkins. It has Meryl Streep in it, which automatically puts it on our radar. But
exactly.
What else? Why is this movie getting the full like award season treatment in the middle of June?
Well, you know, it's a period piece set in the 1940s, biopic about this, aristocratic woman of New York City who was a really actually honorable patron of the arts for her whole life. And, you know, so I went to the screening last night and there was a Q&A afterward with Meryl Streep. And she said, you know, that like all true sort of lovers of the arts, she really just wanted to do the art, you know, but she wasn't. You know, she had been a piano player and had an illness that made her not be able to play anymore. So she pursued singing instead, and with her vast wealth could secure the finest instructors and, you know, an accompanist to help her practice. And yet was like a kind of ear shatteringly awful singer. And she had aspired to be this sort of coloratura soprano. And it was it wasn't like she was singing like, little folk tunes and you can kind of get away with a bad voice. This was like the best singers in the world have trouble with this music. Despite that, she had a legion of loyal fans who were, you know, a lot of the people in her immediate artistic and aristocratic community. But then a record that she had recorded privately sort of got out into the public, and she became this kind of cult figure. And she performed, she reserved her space with her money, but she performed at Carnegie Hall shortly before her death in 1944. And so the movie kind of follows that process. And I think it has a lot. It has Uplift. It has a great star performance from Meryl Streep. It has wonderful co-lead performance from Hugh Grant, of all people. So I don't know. I think here in June, it could have emerged as one of the first contenders I've seen this year.
And it opens in early August, which I always refer to as the help slot or the Julie and Julia slot, the kind of late summer like movie for grown-ups that has worked really well for Meryl Streep in particular in the past. But The Butler was in that spot. I mean, it's kind of a way to get yourself in the conversation with maybe a lighter movie that wouldn't stand a chance in November.
Right. And they put Michael Keaton in that spot this year with the founder.
Yeah.
With the McDonald's guy biopic. Yeah.
I mean, is Meryl Streep convincing as someone who's bad at something? Because I feel like that's going to be a little bit of a hurdle for her.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about it is that when you listen to the actual audio of Florence Foster Jenkins, she's bad, but she's like better than I would be. You know, like she's like, so getting that kind of middle ground of like, I mean, it's noticeably awful, but like there are some notes that aren't, you know, that kind of hit. And she really has clearly studied this audio and she's good at it. And then,
yeah. But I meant more emotionally.
Oh,
like
oh,
how does Meryl Streep get herself in the head of someone who like desperately wants to be good at something, but actually stinks at it?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Wondering.
I mean, I think that what's central to that character is her own kind of dogged belief that she's very good.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the well that Meryl Streep is drawing from in her own experience. You know.
You know, you can still do that. You can rent out Carnegie Hall. I used to edit programs for Carnegie Hall, and I actually went to one of these vanity performances, and it was horrible. They played Handel's Messiah, and this guy turned out he was from my hometown. Every year he would do this concert, and he gave me tickets like fifth row center. And I walked out.
Isn't that horrible? Wow.
I left. He looked at me while I was leaving.
Wow.
But I just couldn't take it. Isn't that awful? I hate myself still for that.
There's too much money in
New York
City.
This episode is going to be all about my self-hatred, by the way. Just warning everybody.
When it comes to musicians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Live performances.
How was the worshipful crowd around Meryl? Did people just lose their minds that they were in her
presence? You know, it was one of these Peggy Siegel events. And so she kind of curates the list with, you know, a lot of, you know, Diane Sawyer, Barbara Walters, Christine Baranski was there, Edie Falco. And then you had kind of like Jamokes like me and my guest, and then a weird mix of like, I think, I don't know, just sort of ladies of the town, you know. And so there were these three women sitting next to me who, you know, fine, it wasn't too much of a distraction, but they were talking throughout the whole movie, like, oh, look at that, oh, that's so me, that's, you know. And then when at the Q&A, when Meryl Streep walks out, just dead silence. I mean, like, they were like
there,
you know,
for
wrapped.
The Q&A,
they were totally there for the Q&A.
Uh-huh.
It
sounds like they were into the movie, though. They were just
they were engaged. I think everyone was. I think the audience reaction, it was, you know, at the DGA Theater on 57th Street, which is good sized house for a small screening room. And it played really well, you know. And I think the first it's directed by Stephen Frears, and the movie does a really good job of building toward the first time we hear her sing. Like, it's not, it doesn't come right away. And it's maybe 20 minutes into the movie. And so they sell it really well. And that was really when the audience, I think, was fully enwrapped with.
Don't you think it's unfair for Meryl Streep just to come through with like an awards worthy movie almost every year? It's just like, give someone else a chance.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Frears too, like, has a really big track record with the Oscars, and like, it's not reliable. Like, he made The Queen, and in the next movie he made Cherie with Michelle Pfeiffer, just dropped off the face of the planet.
Right.
His last movie was the Lance Armstrong movie, The Program, which also dropped off the face of the planet.
Yeah.
Before that, it was Philomena, which was that kind of movie where, like, it seems really slight, and why would anyone care about this movie? And then you see it's really thoughtful and heartfelt, and I really like that movie.
Yeah, I think he's good at that, and I think that this movie has that same quality where it could be played as a kind of a silly, you know, sort of dizzy comedy about this weird rich lady, but he finds the real emotional undercurrent there, and so he gives Meryl Streep and Hugh Grant, who's her devoted husband, a lot to play. And actually, in some weird way, the movie is more focused on Hugh Grant's character. You know, obviously Meryl Streep gets the big showcase singing numbers and the real heavy emotional beats, but Hugh Grant's characters definitely are sort of eyes into the world of the movie.
Does that mean that Meryl could be a supporting rather than, I mean, it's her, it's about her. She's named
title character.
I think they would have trouble doing that, much in the same way that you could have argued that Carol of Carol was a supporting player. I mean, but that didn't work out. So, but I don't know. I think that they could both be, you know, we'll see. I think, you know, all three of us were just talking about how we got our Toronto credential email today. And I'm just like, I have no concept right now of what would even be at the festival. So, I think that my far-reaching knowledge of this season is a little bit dim right now. So this, to me, seems like a sure thing. But I mean,
I'm just excited to see Hugh Grant come back. I feel like it's been a long time since we've got.
Yeah, and they're really good. And you know, he's probably 12 years younger than she is, I think. And but they play very naturally as husband and wife, and you really kind of buy this peculiar sort of kind of arrangement that they have with each other. And yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I left feeling really good, and then I got to go to this party and saw. You know, I was in the elevator going up with Carol Kane, which was really exciting. Mm. And then on the way out, I was in the elevator with Ms. Streep, which was quite exciting.
Hey, now.
What did you do with
Let's hear everything about the elevator ride with Meryl Streep.
My friend and I were waiting to meet her. There had been this kind of, you know, there was a sit-down dinner, and we waited. We didn't want to interrupt her at her table or anything like that. But at the end of the night, as she was about to leave, there was kind of this waiting, you know, scrum of people who are just sort of politely going to say hi, which I was saying to my friend, like, that must be so weird. Every time you leave something, there's this expectation you're going to
enter or anything.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we were really very patiently, I think, waiting our turn. And then this guy was like, oh, hey, can you, she said she would take a picture with me and my wife. Can you take the picture? So he handed his phone to my friend.
Oh, God.
And then we had to stand there for 15 minutes holding this guy's phone. And then we took the picture. And then she was like, okay, you're like, good night. And then like left. So we thought we had missed our chance to say hello. And then I just ended up, I, you know, we're both fast walkers and we didn't really realize that she was right behind us. And we walked into the elevator and then turned around and then there she was. So she was, you know, she just, it was like a short elevator ride.
Normal elevator ride.
You know, I said, oh, we really love the movie. And she said, you know, it's nice to have a little tonic sometimes. And then sort of returned to talk to her publicist. And we were like trying to think that over. And then we decided that she was talking about like the uplift of the movie.
Yeah, like,
it's a feel good, even though there's sort of sadness in it. It's like a feel good movie. I think that's what she was referring to.
It's either that or a gin reference.
Right. Who knows?
That sounds right. But that sounds right.
Regardless, she was wearing, I don't know, 4-inch heels. She looked fantastic.
Because
she's kind of like, she wore like a sort of padded suit in the movie because the real Jenkins was a bigger woman. And so it was, it was funny to see the movie and then have her come out and just this very sort of, you know, slim, glamorous.
But, you know, in that recent story that we ran, the cover story, which was all about her kind of battle with Dustin Hoffman.
Right.
On Kramer versus Kramer.
You know, you get a sense from that of her being, you know, knowing she was great, but not having the status yet and really kind of having to fight. And that it was this sort of, I mean, Dustin Hoffman was acting like seemingly a big jerk in that period. But now she's just in full flower. Don't you get that feeling whenever you see her? She's just like, this is where she belongs. Like, she has accomplished what she knew she would accomplish from the beginning. Yeah. And now she's just kind of enjoying life, don't you think?
Yeah, totally. So the Q&A was moderated by William Ivy Long, who is, of course, this lauded costume designer. I believe he's either the chairman or the president of the American Theater Wing. Like, this is a big guy in his industry, in his field. And he seemed very nervous to interview her. And they were like friends from Yale. And she just, you know, was very held her own, like sort of decided what she wanted to answer and what didn't. And, you know, it was just a very like, she just seemed.
What didn't she answer?
Oh, I mean, you know, he had these kind of like long questions and she would sort of answer a portion of them or maybe just kind of pivot and just kind of say something else about whatever. And it was very much like she could have just kind of extemporaneously talked. She didn't need the sort of buffer of someone interviewing her.
Did she talk about playing Trump at Shakespeare in the Park?
No, sadly she didn't. I wish that.
Oh yeah, no Trump. Was any Trump conversation?
No, he didn't. He didn't ask her. He was a very sort of
that must have been negotiated.
I'm sure. Yeah,
or maybe he's.
There's
just
a corner
not,
of the world where no one's talking about Donald Trump for a while. It's probably a good thing.
Yeah,
probably good.
But yeah, it was a lovely, you know, early summer, late spring evening with Ms. Streep, and it's a movie that I really, you know, had been on my radar just because of who was in it, but I didn't have any expectations for liking it, and was really happily surprised. So I would urge everyone to keep an eye on that one.
Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah,
it's happening.
Start here.
All right.
When I was 16 years old, my father told me that if I didn't give up music, he'd cut me off. Of course, he didn't understand. Music is my life.
Cosme McMoon.
That's me, sir.
Maestro, this is the talented young man I was telling you about.
And let's get started.
She's remarkable, isn't she?
She can be a little flat.
Flat?
It defies medical science.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So the Tony Awards were held on Sunday night, and they earned really great ratings, which was expected because Hamilton is a phenomenon and James Corden is a fairly popular host, but was also probably more than CBS could possibly have hoped for. And it was also a pretty good show. I mean, Richard, you and I both watched it. I at one point I turned on Game of Thrones, but I had watched most of the show by then, so I give myself credit. And Mike, you've caught up on some of the highlights since then. Richard, why was this a show that made me delay watching Game of Thrones? Like, what made this so worth watching this year?
Well, I think the Hamilton factor is probably chief among it for most people. You know, you talked about the ratings being the highest in 15 years. I think Hamilton is probably solely to credit for that. But I think also, you know, the show opened in two interesting ways, one of which was, of course, at the very top of the show, Corden had to acknowledge what had happened in Orlando. And, you know, just because it was a mind-boggling tragedy, but also because the gay community and the theater community are, as we all know, inextricably linked. And so, you know, so it began with this very sort of respectful, somber note, and then did a nice, you know, sort of 180 and into the kind of planned, rehearsed opening number, which was a fun throwback to kind of the sort of either Tony's openers or Oscar openers, where they would kind of insist themselves into different shows or movies. And he just
had a Billy Crystal opening the Oscar type vibe.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that the really nice kind of punch of talking about little kids and then growing up to be on the Tony stage. And they did a nice sort of reveal that all the acting nominees were on stage at the end of the, you know, at the end of the number.
The musical acting nominees.
Exactly.
Oh, you can really believe that too with James Corden when he's like, hey, if you're like a little dorky kid at home, like this could be you someday, because he was that dorky kid like 18 months ago.
No, seriously.
One even knew who he was.
Well, in the US, I think he was pretty famous in UK.
And I think that everyone was really in need of some levity and some sort of inspiration after a really rough day of news. And I think that really propelled well into the show. And then there was just this kind of compelling narrative about, okay, how many awards is Hamilton going to win, and, you know, et cetera. So I think they did it really well. I think it was not, I wish sometimes that there had been a little bit more spreading of the wealth in terms of what shows had won. But when you have a phenomenon like Hamilton, I mean, it's a really sort of, its mandate is sort of undeniable. I think maybe on the play side of things, like there was a little bit of variance, but I think that it might not have been the most compelling show in terms of like surprise winners or anything like that. But I think that they made up for that in other ways.
Yeah, Mike, so you watched the opening number, which as you were saying, is kind of has a Billy Crystal vibe about it. Like, does it feel like something that anything but the Tonys could ever get away with, like where you have all the singing and dancing? I mean, you've got like the Tonys lend themselves so much to stagecraft, which is what award shows are. And it's like, this is how we wind up with movie montages that everyone thinks are so pointless. Like the Tonys has such an ace in the hole. But I just feel like there's got to be something we can capture from this for the Oscars, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, let's first talk about what no one else can do. I mean, the fact is that all of the people on that stage are really good at acting and singing in front of a live audience, and also are thirsty enough to like do anything that anybody tells them to do if they're going to get to be on TV. Whereas if you're talking about, you know, movie stars, a lot of them, basically the main credential for being a movie star is that when somebody puts a camera on you and then projects it on a giant screen, you have to kind of be somebody that people can't take their eyes off. So whether or not you can act is almost irrelevant. Many of them can act and many of them can't. And, you know, some of the people on that stage you are familiar from TV, less so movies. But I don't know that you can really ask a bunch of movie stars to go up and kind of put on that kind of show. I think it's hard. And so then you're finding yourself, you know, right there at a disadvantage. But I mean, like Richard said, it was a callback almost to some of that Billy Crystal stuff. I think having somebody like James Corden, who's also like up for anything too and trying to prove himself, helps bring a lot of energy to it. Having that theme of like, you can do this, like reaching out to those kids. There's such a different thing in the theater of theater kids. There's a community of them around the country, and I was one of them. And you know, you're an underdog. Like you certainly feel that way because you're not on the football team, you know, and you're not on the basketball team, you're not a cheerleader, you're kind of like a dork. And they tend to do well later in life. It was believable, the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know, how do the Oscars tap into, I wouldn't know where to start with the Oscars. How do you tap into like an exciting narrative that way and say there's some reason reason to watch this other than us just congratulating one another on being freaks of nature.
It's easy to forget that Seth MacFarlane did some version of this when he hosted the Oscars, where he had Charlize Theron and Channing Tatum kind of come out and do this like dance together, and it was like very old fashioned. That was kind of, that's kind of the like jazz standard version of Seth MacFarlane.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the whole problem with Seth's thing was really the message, which was a kind of like a, wasn't it sort of, it seemed like a not very inspiring message of like, well, I'm a kind of a witty straight guy who's going to make fun of everybody.
Yeah. I mean, well, he kind of wrecked it all with, and he did the whole We Saw Your Boobs song later in the show, which
yeah,
is now
that's
all I
what
can
it
think
was.
About.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, he had such a different vibe than James Corden, but does seem to have the love of the old school song and dance thing that I think is why they hired him to do the Oscars. I mean, I don't know. You can have James Corden host the Oscars as far
I mean,
as
Hugh Jackman tried to do something similar too.
Yeah.
Right?
Remember he brought Anne Hathaway up on stage and she sang with him first. He like pulled her out of her seat and, you know, I mean, it was obviously
she did a Frost Nixon joke, which plants that in history when
and
it happened.
I think that was an interesting experiment in melding the kind of Tonys, because Hugh Jackman's hosted the Tonys very successfully before.
Yeah.
In melding the Tonys kind of, you know, let's put on a show like moxie and uncynicism with the Oscars sort of more glam remove. I don't know that it quite works. And I think that you're right, Mike. There is kind of a big divide there in terms of the talent pool and the kind of talent that it is. I think that one thing that the Tonys, I mean, let's, you know, address a sort of more sociological thing is you look at the winners of the Tonys on Sunday night and like a diversity issue was a lot lesser there. I mean, like they had like all four winners in the musical acting categories were people of color and, you know, a really diverse array of nominees beyond that. And I think that's something that the movie industry in general could look to from theater. But in terms of the Tonys versus the Oscars, I think that general just sort of like they really kind of pull people out of the shadows and it's this exciting moment. And the Tony really means that it's kind of like a career starting or a career confirmed. And then the Oscars mean that, too. But it always feels a little slicker and sleeker. And I think it's a little bit harder to emotionally hook into.
Well, nobody's buying movie stars as underdogs, you know,
right.
And there's something not to keep hitting the same thing, but like it's not really inspiring. I mean, it's inspiring in a kind of way of like, wow, it would be nice to be at the absolute pinnacle of the world.
Right.
But that's there's no ladder coming down there. And so I don't know how you kind of get people excited. It's tricky.
I don't know. I mean, when you see something like Lupita Nyong'o win, like she's someone who was like fresh out of Yale drama.
That's
like
true.
She was nobody. Like that's the kind of Oscar story that everyone wants to tell. Brie Larson to some extent, like she had been working forever to get to the point where she was. I mean, when George Clooney wins an Oscar, it's one thing, but you do have these come from nothing stories. That's what the Oscars are all built on. It's like every other Best Actress nominee has that narrative. So there's some of it to it, but then they go on to be rich and famous movie stars starring Kong Skull Island. And then you get to
last long.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to one of the parties after the show to do a little write up about it, but also just to like try to like get out of my head. And it was a nice party. It was not the Hamilton party, which was sort of where everyone, you know, wanted to be. But one thing I noticed, you know, there were as you would, I'm sure have seen at the VF Oscar party and other post awards things, you know, people walking around kind of cradling their awards and people kind of well wishing. I found that for my own purposes, because it was a Tony's, because it was theater people who I sort of still feel like are my people, I was introducing myself to people. I said hello to Andrew Lloyd Webber and George C. Wolfe and Reed Birney, who was a best featured actor winner on Sunday night. You know, and I think that sort of...
I knew about this because we received several complaints the next morning, actually.
Oh, right. Yeah. This will be my last episode. Yeah.
Andrew Lloyd Webber has shut down this podcast.
Oh, I know all about this, Richard. Yeah. I got six emails about it.
Oh, God. Okay. But, you know, I think that there's something about the Tony's accessibility, and maybe that's for a really kind of niche audience member, like, you know, a theater person or someone who is a fan of theater. But for that reason, they sort of emotionally more resonate with me. But I still think the Oscars sweep me away more in their sort of grandeur. But I'm just glad both exist, frankly.
Yeah. And if people can watch the Tonys and they can see something like that opening number, even in a year when there's not a Hamilton that's like an actual bestseller album, like hopefully people, I mean, it's hard when you to engage in the contest when it's all shows you haven't seen before, which I think.
I mean, Hamilton is the reason, as you said, that people were watching this year. And this kind of uplifting spirit fits in with what Hamilton's all about.
Sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's a whole like, I'm not going to miss my shot thing. And in many years there isn't that. And I guess, you know, it doesn't have the same vibe. And I don't want to trash the Oscars because I just think it's a really hard show to pull off. It's just tough.
Yep.
And it's unclear exactly what you can do other than hand out awards and have nice speeches. Part of me thinks to just do that and make it an hour and a half.
Yeah. No.
Well, yeah.
Having it. Well, that's what the SAG Awards are. They're just speeches and they're great. Yeah. I mean, and we talked, you know, we were talking about Lin-Manuel Miranda's speech earlear where he read a sonnet, which is it wasn't a freestyle rap, which is his usual tradition. And it was referencing the events in Orlando and very heartfelt. And that to me is kind of the like live TV magic you get in award shows where it's like you're watching an emotion play out, like something real that no one could have planned that makes me like watching basically any award show. Mike, you're more skeptical.
I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda, he's so talented and he's got such access to his emotions and I want to love it, but I don't know why I get the gag reflex a little bit. I guess anytime someone makes themselves cry with a poem they wrote, I'm kind of throwing up in my mouth.
So you're not coming to my reading, that's what you're saying.
But I think it's like the parts of me that are kind of revolted are, I feel like, arguably I'm internalizing the bullies that I knew in high school who were like, you theater, you know, dork or whatever.
Yeah, James Corden's whole opening thing was supposed to make you get rid of that.
I know.
And
yet it didn't. No. Yet there it was. Whatever. But the guy's insanely talented, you know, and Hamilton is a brilliant show. Into the Heights was a brilliant show. And so I'm happy for him. But don't make me look at his tweets.
Well, he'll probably be at the Oscars for the music for Moana, which debuted its trailer during the Tonys.
A real synergy moment.
Yeah, and he was singing in the song, which like, I don't really know why he's not in the movie. But yeah, he's that EGOT's coming fast. So get used to it.
He's going to be the president probably, which would be great. I'm fine with it.
Yeah,
he'd be much better than some of the other options. Just I don't have to read his tweets. I'm fine.
My wife's the reason anything gets done. She nudges me towards promise by degrees. She is a perfect symphony of one. Our son is her most beautiful reprise. We chase the melodies that seem to find us until they're finished songs and start to play. When senseless acts of tragedy remind us that nothing here is promised. Not one day. The show is proof that history remembers. We live through times when hate and fear seem stronger. We rise and fall and light from dying embers, remembrances that hope and love last longer. And love is 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 love cannot be killed or swept aside. I sing Vanessa's symphony. Eliza tells her story. Now fill the world with music, love, and pride. Thank you so much for this.
As our own Julie Miller wrote yesterday at VanityFair.com, based on a piece from The Atlantic, it's going to be a really dark summer. And the relationship between the movie studios and the young people who are supposed to buy all the tickets is looking dimmer than ever. 2016 is probably going to sell the fewest movie tickets of any year in the last century. And then when you look even closer, moviegoers between 18 and 24 are dropping off in movie ticket purchases faster than any other group. They're still buying tickets. Young people are still the biggest group going to the movies, but they are more likely to spend time on Snapchat or Instagram or name Silicon Valley company here. In the summer when we see all these movies that are just aimed for young people, I mean, you see Warcraft, you see Finding Dory, which is a different group of young people, even Independence Day Resurgence, which is, Richard, when you and I were children, it was aimed at us and now it's still aimed at us on some level. It gets depressing to realize that even those people aren't going to the movies anymore. So should Hollywood be panicking? Is the system kind of headed for a collapse and this summer is just more proof of it?
I think there's definitely cause for concern. And I think what it really relates to is just it's just more options now, you know. And I think that something that these pieces have kind of highlighted is that people under the age of 18 are their movie going rates are going up. And then people over 40, that same is true. It's just that like middle demo that like everyone cares about so much. That's like just really dropped off. And I think it's because, you know, they have all these devices in their hands and, you know, Netflix and whatever. And I think that there might just have to be some sort of a change in expectation in terms of American box office. Like we might, in the same way that the television networks have had to kind of completely change their ratings paradigm, the idea of how much you spend on a movie, how much you spend on marketing a movie might just have to change. I think it's interesting that internationally, especially Latin America and, Asia, that the markets are exploding, you know. So I think that we'll see, as we already have, a lot more movies that tend to kind of cater to that market, which
Warcraft is a huge example. It made like four times as much money in China over the weekend that it did here, maybe even more than that. Like, it's a huge success.
Which means that even though it bombed here, it could still get sequels.
Oh, certainly, yeah. I mean, Pacific Rim was kind of the original example of that, and it kind of just squeaked by into having a sequel. But I think Warcraft is going to be like a really successful franchise, kind of like Ice Age, which continues to put out movies that we all kind of look and think, huh, that's still happening. But
right.
It makes a huge amount of money of its money overseas, which is a trend that's been going on for a while now.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that Derek Thompson, writing in The Atlantic, pointed out is when you first look at it, you think, oh, the sequel strategy is failing. But it's like, no, actually, the sequel strategy is just the only thing left.
Right.
And it's not working quite as well as it had been. But it's still, Hollywood is still a giant business. And, compares, as he put it, it compares favorably to any even sports thing you want to put it up against. But basically, the only way to get butts in seats is to create a giant tentpole franchise and do a bunch of sequels, which is a bit of a bummer for people who I think, grew up maybe watching films that were more about individual original storytelling. Although we can't complain too much because so much of that is now happening, in the kind of premium cable, Netflix, even Amazon realm,
yeah,
right?
I think it's less mourning for the world of like Kramer versus Kramer being a really big box office hit because TV has really filled that niche really well. Like, if you're looking for stories about grown-ups having real problems, like, you can watch Bloodline, you can watch Orange is the New Black. And it's more like the original Independence Day, which is like based on nothing, had a whole teaser trailer that was just like one shot of a spaceship and everyone got excited and was this kind of like out of nowhere hit. It cost a bunch of money. It was a blockbuster in the very traditional
right.
model, but it wasn't saying like you need to read 10 years worth of comic books to understand what's going on.
Well, but everyone's optimizing based on successes like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now there's like eight of those a year.
Yeah.
So they're not gonna blow out the way that the one
and,
did.
But
before.
All of them are based on something that you are already familiar with. None of them are gonna be like, huh, I wonder what Jeff Goldblum
right.
is doing in this movie.
Yeah, because nobody wants to take the risk mm-hmm. of they're looking for, which I get, right? I mean, they're looking for built-in audiences. All right, we know that 20 million people play Warcraft, so even if this movie stinks, like some group of them are going to come out. And I have no idea how many people play
Warcraft. I think it's like 100 million.
It's like the population of many countries.
Yeah, but like even if this movie stinks, some percentage of them are going to come out. You're always just like a lot of it is just trying to cover the sort of downside of the investment, right?
Yeah.
But one thing that I think is interesting is what's really disappearing is the self-contained two-hour thing
mm-hmm.
because really everything's moving to either a series of movie sequels or a series on TV. But in every case, actually, it turns out that when people like something, they want to spend 6, 8, 10, 40 hours with it, not just have that one experience
mm-hmm.
that's like completely unique to itself.
Yeah, and that is something I do mourn. I mean, because I think, as much as there is a plethora of good TV out there, I think that we've also kind of reached a point where like there's a reliance on that sort of slowness of storytelling that I think sometimes kind of doesn't end that well, and I miss the sort of assured 2-hour story that people are trying to tell us that is standalone and has no sort of, anything proceeding it, like, I miss that. Another actually Atlantic writer, David Sims, has written a lot about kind of peak TV and his problems with that. And I think that that's an issue that is interesting, that's where our kind of dramas are going, our Kramer versus Kramers are going, but also that the big franchise movies are now kind of just elongated. I mean, you mm-hmm. really could just view the Avengers movies as a, two seasons of a Netflix series or, Spectacular or something.
By the way, we're talking about the Tonys. Why doesn't Lin-Manuel do Hamilton 2? You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
We're living it.
This amazing.
America is Hamilton 2.
The next one could be Jefferson.
Well, this is what's so satisfying about something like Now You See Me, the original one, which came out in 2013, which this Atlantic piece referenced that summer was Now You See Me and World War Z, which were these two like genuine surprise hits. Both of them have since fostered sequels. I liked Now You See Me 2, Richard, you did
also,
too.
World War Z, based on a comic book. Wasn't it?
Based on a novel.
Yeah.
A graphic
really
novel.
Just
a novel.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's really different from what the movie was. So it's like almost an original story.
Okay.
Now You See Me, as crazy and nonsensical as it is, was a pure original story.
Yeah. It's a documentary about
about how magic is real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when something like that happens, you kind of just have to like feel gladness in your heart that it's possible for a contained 2-hour story like that.
I think it is possible. And I think that if anything, there's a lesson from this 2016, which has been particularly hard on the sequels. But you look at what those sequels were, a sequel to The Huntsman or Snow White and the Huntsman, which was popular, but not like huge.
And also lost its star.
Yeah, lost Kristen Stewart. Yeah.
Or got rid of her, depending on whatever happened behind the scenes.
You know, the Neighbors sequel, which, you know, sort of shifted its focus. And like, I don't know, the comedy is hard to sort of repeat. I think the biggest one is Alice Through the Looking Glass, which, yes, the original Alice in Wonderland that Tim Burton directed in, I think,
2010, it came out right after 10, Avatar.
Was made $1 billion, but that was right at the sort of, reemergence of 3D. And an interest in 3D, but also 3D ticket pricing, and the institutional memory is not good on that movie because the movie was not well received. Yes, a lot of people saw it, but not a lot of people liked it. Mm-hmm. And then to wait 6 years to do a big bloated, you know, kind of real obvious cash in follow up, like that's kind of thinking that, like, I don't know, maybe some group think in Hollywood sort of broke down when the 2016 spring summer schedule was being built. And it's like, okay, I think this year was probably more of an anomaly and hopefully a lesson of like in better curating what you kind of sequelize, because not everything is going to work. And that's been proven multiple times this year.
I'm going to throw out one more theory here, which is that storytelling is more original when formats are new. And you brought up 3D and, you know, you think about like even FM radio, but before FM radio became the world's most overprogrammed thing, people didn't know what to do with it. My uncle was an FM radio host in the 60s, I think, and he basically would like smoke a joint and like leave a side of an album on and sometimes forget to turn it over. Like they were figuring it out. The internet, we lived through the internet being that, blogs being that. Now I think it's going to be VR, among other things. I think
or
if you
Snapchat
wanted to.
Or Vine or.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you wanted to do something really creative and inventive, you would do it there. And so on the one hand, it's like there's enough data now for the suits to come into Hollywood and be like, we need a tent pole. There needs to be this kind of, you know, audience built in if we're going to spend $200 million making a movie and another $100 million marketing it. But on the other hand, you can see why young people would be like, I'm not interested in this. Look at all the inventiveness that's happening with this incredibly simple technology. And then the really visionary people going, I want to figure out VR, like be the first to figure it out. And right. I'm really excited to see what happens in the next 18 months in
that
realm. We've
seen so much of it at Sundance in Toronto. There's, you know, the presence of VR technology there is really increasing and already pretty prevalent. So, and I think, hitting on like sort of what young people kind of turning away from these kind of prepackaged big movie spectaculars is that a crucial thing about a lot of the media that younger people are consuming, it's direct, it's personal, it's, you know, it's kids in their bedroom or vloggers or, you know, whatever. Like they get to know Lily Pons, the Vine star, through a series of hundreds of little videos, and it's really intimate, and I think it removes this sort of sheen of celebrity and, you know, sort of unattainable, untouchable stardom that, you know, the Hollywood industry has really, you know, relied on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's obviously that's not going to go anywhere. But I think that younger people are less impressed by it. And I think that's something that they need to figure out.
But, you know, it's interesting, too. You just see these cycles repeating themselves, because I just saw the news that VidCon is going to prevent attendees from having direct access to the video stars because of the murder of that young woman.
Right.
And
the other murder in Florida over the weekend. Several to sort through.
Yeah. And so, you know, it just these cycles repeat themselves. Right. It starts as, oh, it's a cool thing. That's like, I mean, you know, the whole star system was invented as a publicity scheme to just make these people seem more interesting than they were.
Right.
And they could still live in normal middle class houses, you know, in the middle of L.A.
Yeah.
And then it evolved into the bizarre scenario that we see today. But
I think that the way that the Hollywood creates new stars, I think that, you know, it's always a kind of mysterious process, but you kind of watch the mechanism working, you know, where like they're okay, here's Ansel Elgort, here are his roles, and we're going to put him in, and we're going to put him in the romantic drama, we're going to put him in the action movie, that formula seems a little bit more vague online, and you know, so the top tier YouTube talent at VidCon, for very valid security reasons, is not, you know, they're not going to be accessible by the fans, but another few tiers down will be, and And, you know, I have been following YouTube a lot for the past few years, and there's already maybe two new generations below the people I started watching who are getting just as big, and I've never heard of them, you know. Right. So the kind of process, like the cyclical thing you're talking about, happens just a lot, you know, mm-hmm. more quickly online. So we'll see. I don't know. I think eventually it'll probably be as institutional as Hollywood, but not for a while.
It'll be really interesting to check in at the end of the summer and see if all this doom and gloom even pans out, and, you know, watch Suicide Squad make $500 million and then everyone, it feels great again.
That is kind of like the big, I think, you know, just looking forward, like in terms of box office hopes, you've mentioned Independence Day. We have Jason Bourne. There's the third Star Trek film coming out.
Ghostbusters,
obviously, and Suicide Squad. I would say probably my bet would be that Suicide Squad, even though Batman vs. Superman, which is in the same universe, had a little bit of trouble at the American box office, like, I think that Suicide Squad is probably the brightest.
Yeah, and light, it's going to be depicted as like a surprise hit because it's, you know.
Right. Even though it's been marketed for the last 3 years, like, yeah, extensively.
Exactly. No,
yeah.
It's been very carefully put together.
Yeah.
You know, it's got Will Smith and Margot Robbie and all these, you know, people who.
Jared Leto's Joker thing, which has been like just some weird confluence of PR strategy and like weird method stuff.
Well,
like, it's just.
Yes, secretly yeah. feel like you've seen him play the Joker in four movies already.
Yeah. I kind of feel like I know.
In a couple of Vanity Fair videos, I think, from the New Establishment Summit, actually.
Yeah, he's using us as part of his long.
Yeah, it's viral marketing. He's no dummy. I hope it's Ghostbusters. That'd be great. I don't think it will be, but that'd be nice.
Well, that's going to be a whole other conversation of the women trying to stake their claim in summer blockbuster season. And
it's going to be like a Bernie Bros situation.
Oh my God.
I guess it already is.
It's already so much worse than that. It's that's definitely a narrative we'll be following.
Well,
this summer.
Okay. Maybe it'll be Florence Foster Jenkins.
That will be it. $500 million.
There you go. Shocking nobody.
All from the Buzz campaign that started right here.
Yeah, you heard it here first.
Before we go, we're going to take a look back at Oscar history, inspired by this week's new release, Finding Dory, which is a sequel to Finding Nemo. None of us have seen Finding Dory yet, so we'll have to save that conversation for later. But it won the Best Animated Feature Oscar for the film's release in 2003. No surprise at the time. But what's interesting is looking back at the Best Picture race that year, which is more fascinating than I was giving it credit for. So I wanted to go back and re-arbitrate that. So Mike and Richard, of the nominees for the films of 2003, what should have won Best Picture? Your choices are Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, which won, Lost in Translation, Master and Commander, Mystic River, and Seabiscuit.
Wow. That's such a...
What a crazy group, right?
It really is.
This was the kind of crowning, like, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, because it had been nominated.
Yeah, it got the payoff for three movies.
Right. And everyone knew it was going to win.
Even though it's, I think, the weakest of those three. I think a lot of people think that. With its, you know, 45-minute ending. so I don't know. I mean, I think that to cap off what was Peter Jackson's kind of magnum opus, like, I think, sure. Like, give it that. But
yes.
But if I was just viewing these in a vacuum, you know, separate of context, this is going to be a weird one. I would give it to Master and Commander.
I loved.
I think
Master
that movie
Commander.
Is exquisitely done. I think it was supposed to be more of a series that never happened.
Yeah.
I think it's probably, and he's a favorite of mine, Peter Weir. I think it's maybe the last great movie he did. And I would give it to that. I think that Mystic River. I have my feelings about Clint Eastwood movies. Seabiscuit, fine. Lost in Translation didn't work for me then.
Oh, yeah.
Still doesn't work for me now, even though I like Coppola and Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. But yeah, anyway, Master and Commander, that's my pick.
Well, when you see Mystic River there, maybe if it had won, the Million Dollar Baby couldn't have won the year after, and then, you know, all of history gets changed.
Well, then Annette Bening has an Oscar.
Yeah. that's how that works.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be Lost in Translation for me either, even though I liked it a lot. I remember the first time I saw it, the credits rolled, and I thought, what a snotty little movie. Like, at some level, the whole thing was just like, I'm so great that this guy is just obsessed with me, and I, like, lead him around for a whole movie, and then at the end, I'm just like, I'm not actually interested in you. Like, that's which I'm sure is a very real felt experience for a lot of women, but I there was a part of me that just couldn't find a foothold in that film. As nice as the performance was, that was the Bill Murray comeback performance,
that was,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was great. Seabiscuit, yeah, I don't know. I think Mystic River was great, but so insanely bleak and dark. But I remember Sean Penn giving some really hilariously great performances.
Is that my daughter in there?
Yeah.
Tim Robbins won his Oscar for that, right?
Tim Robbins won his Oscar for that. Yep. Yeah,
a lot of Boston accents. Yeah, how did the Boston accents work for you?
I think my mom and I, we saw that movie together. We still quote the Laura Linney or mock the Laura Linney accent, where at the end and she's basically like doing like some bizarre Kennedy or X thing, don't worry about it, where she kind of reveals her sort of darkness.
Yeah.
That's a bad accent. Sean Penn's is fine, but yeah, that movie is so bleak and turgid and just sort of like
insanely dark.
So I wouldn't have gone for that, but people were super into that movie that year.
Yeah, they were. I did not like it much either. I would stick up for Lost in Translation. I don't know that I would give it the Oscar. I think Lord of the Rings was probably dessert. And I liked Return of the King a lot. But I feel like it's the most indelible of these movies. Like, it has lasted in pop culture in a way. Like, you still remember Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray and like the gifs of them pop up on the internet and the mood of it. Just to have it be a movie directed by a woman that is feminine, that is not The Hurt Locker. It's really like, it's a romance, kind of. It's about emotions and people. I like that. It's an anomaly in Best Picture, especially at this time when it was just nominees. Like, it's not even, The Help was a nominee that was directed by a man. But yeah, just to have this kind of really different kind of story making it in Best Picture, I like celebrating that.
Yeah, and looking at, its competition, like, it's this very small sort of artsy kind of interior movie, gorgeous filmmaking, one of the best soundtracks of its decade, I think.
Yes.
And, it certainly has its strengths.
It's probably the one I would watch most willingly right now, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though I have my issues with it. But I mean, on the other hand, it makes you grapple. I mean, if you're grappling with the issues, you kind of care in a way. Like, I don't really care about Seabiscuit one way or another.
Like, yeah. I know that I saw Seabiscuit. I don't. Yeah. I don't remember anything about it.
Yeah.
Tobey Maguire, horse. Chris
he has
Cooper,
red hair.
Right. Yeah.
And literally the thought of watching The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, is just, I couldn't possibly
do it. I've watched the other two Towers and the original.
I don't know that I ever saw it.
Multiple times.
Return of the King.
And the third one I've just saw the one time in the theater. I've never seen it since.
Wow, yeah. Guys.
Well, I just after the second one, I was just like, okay, I get it.
Oh, yeah. You never yeah. Plugged in.
I don't know. And I'm a Game of Thrones guy.
So you missed the big musical number in the third one.
Yeah. Lin-Manuel Miranda, very young.
Yep.
Reads a sonnet at the end.
Fantasy does not usually work for me, and I love the Lord of the Rings movies. I love the phenomenon of it.
So. It just seemed like trees were fighting for like 6.5 hours, and at some point
there are no
trees
in the third one. Okay. Barely any trees in the third one.
Yeah. So by the way, I read the books as a kid and was 100,000% swept away.
Maybe,
but it just got, it's just too much.
Maybe it's finally time for you to see the Lord of the Rings.
I don't know. Okay.
You got to see Jurassic Park first, and then see Return of the King.
There's a lot I got to see, guys.
I should confess, if we're doing this, and you mentioned Finding Dory. I've never seen Finding Nemo.
Mm.
Yeah. I was traveling through Europe on sort of like, a backpacky, summer trip with friends from college when it came out, and it was this big phenomenon. And I remember like being in an internet cafe in Prague and reading like the EW box office report and being like, I can't believe I'm missing it. And then by the time I got back, people were done talking about it. And,
yeah.
This is what I keep trying to tell Katie about being too cool and busy with your cool life to watch some of these movies.
I was probably stoned in Amsterdam.
Yeah. Like, wasted on good drugs. Didn't watch Finding Nemo.
Yep. Sorry.
I mean, I saw Mystic River on a plane. So, I'm not saying that I was catching up with everything at the time.
Right.
I did see Seabiscuit, and what a load of good that did me. So glad I saw Seabiscuit.
Yeah. You need to watch that again tonight. We'll have a report next week.
All right. We'll all do our homework for the Oscars of 2003.
I'm so sorry. See, I suffer from short-term memory loss.
Short-term memory loss. I don't believe this.
No, it's true. I forget things almost instantly. It runs in my family. Well, I mean, at least I think it does. Where are they?
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you, as always, for listening. And please rate and review us on iTunes if you can. It really helps us find new listeners. You can find all of us at vanityfair.com and on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich. Mike?
Mike_Hogan.
And Richard?
Rylaws.
This episode was produced by Kristen Meinzer and edited by Tim Einenkel, with special help from Sam Dingman, who has left us for Los Angeles this week. Thanks, as always, to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for the sexiest night in a skyscraper goes to Richard Lawson.
I was in the elevator going up with Carol Kane, which was really exciting. And then on the way out, I was in the elevator with Ms. Streep.
Want to try another take?
Well, I don't see why. That seemed perfect to me.